and welcome to this edition of The Assault on Public Education. I'm Cheryl. Today on the show, you'll hear an interview between Jonathan Pelto and author Anthony Cody. And then I'll be joined in the studio by Jonathan Pelto for an update on the current legislative session on issues concerning education, and we'll also discuss the right of parents to opt their children out of the high-stakes testing and the frightening issue of student data collection. So let's begin with the interview between Jonathan Pelto and Anthony Cody. Anthony Cody is a retired teacher, author, and blogger, and education activist. His recent book, The Educator and the Oligarch, was published in late 2014. He's been on a book tour around the country, and this is an interview about the book and his work. And here it is.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. Another in a series of discussions about the education issues around the country, the assault on public education by the corporate education reform industry. And we're particularly honored to have one of the leaders of the effort to shine the light of truth on these issues, Anthony Cody, a science teacher from Oakland who has years of experience, and with that experience has written a book that truly challenges the most fundamental elements of the corporate education reform industry. The book, which came out in October of 2014, just 2 months ago, entitled The Educator and the Oligarch, A Teacher Challenges the Gates Foundation. Anthony, I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
When I read this book, there were two things that came to mind. One was the story of David and Goliath. And I imagine as you laid out these issues, you there with the slingshot taking on Goliath. And the other was that I was curious about how they were going to respond because you really left them no place to hide. But for those that are relatively new to these issues, I think there's a growing awareness, the Common Core testing, some kind of inappropriate teacher evaluation process, the undermining of our public schools. But maybe you could just start out by explaining a little bit about who the Gates Foundation is and the role that they've played, and particularly why you decided to take this on in the way that you have.
Well, the Gates Foundation, of course, is the reservoir of money that Bill Gates has put aside into a tax-sheltered place where he can continue to control that money but not pay taxes on it. The Gates Foundation has something like a $40 billion endowment, making it one of the largest foundations in the world. And they maintain an investment portfolio with that vast majority of that $40 billion. And invest money in all sorts of things like Monsanto, and for a while they were investing in a private prison corporation, other investments that have been challenged over the years. But my main concern with them really came about because of their investment in education reform in the United States. And what I discovered starting in around 2010 when a propaganda documentary was released called Waiting for Superman, and the Gates Foundation was very involved in heavily promoting that movie. They spent a couple of million dollars directly promoting that movie domestically, and they also invested in something called Education Nation on NBC. Bill Gates was going around with Michelle Rhee, basically declaring that public schools were broken. Bad teachers couldn't be fired, teachers had contracts for life, that we needed charter schools to fix things, and that we needed to emphasize test scores, measuring teacher performance by test scores, and so on. So that's when I started writing about the Gates Foundation and really trying to understand what Bill Gates's agenda was. Because the Gates Foundation is not an old school philanthropy that just sort of hands out money to feed starving children. They have a very strategic plan with their philanthropy, and they want to drive public education in a certain direction. And what I discovered is their agenda is really built around three concepts. The first one is that measurement is all important. And so Bill Gates said that we're finally going to bring this science to the teaching profession. He said teaching profession doesn't know very much about good teaching because teaching was not being monitored and measured in terms of student outcomes. So that's why we have the Common Core and the tests aligned with the Common Core, so that every student in the nation should be getting the same set of tests aligned with the same set of standards, and then we can compare. Now, why is it so important to compare teachers and curriculum? It's so important because the second pillar is the marketplace. In Bill Gates's worldview, innovation comes from market competition. He doesn't recognize innovation if it doesn't come from that source. So in order to have market competition, you have to have market discipline. You have to have a means of determining what is working and what isn't. And so that's why it's so important to have one set of standardized tests, one set of standardized outcomes, so that we can say we can give one group of kids this curriculum, we can give another group of kids a different curriculum or teaching method, and we can see which works better, and that should drive innovation. The third piece that the Gates Foundation, Bill Gates, believes in is technology. And so the tests should be delivered on computers, which the new Common Core tests are delivered on computers. There's almost a religious belief that because technology has been so effective in transforming things like commerce and other aspects of our lives, that there's a revolution about to happen in education. The education will similarly become far more efficient, and they use the term personalization because the idea is that each student has, the computers get to know each student. They know what each student needs because massive data has accumulated so that they have profiles of students. So as soon as you start working on the computer, the system starts collecting information about what your capabilities are and then compare you to this vast database of previous human beings and decide, oh, you must be type A643 and you need, therefore, this particular set of educational challenges. So that's kind of the vision that is operating here. And what the Gates Foundation has done is they have invested hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, into promoting this agenda in a whole variety of ways. They invest in think tanks that do so-called research papers that support these practices. They invest in the political process so that, for example, like in the state of Washington, Gates invested several million dollars to make sure that charter schools could be in place in the state of Washington, because until a year ago, the law did not allow for charter schools. And they've also made strategic partnerships with the U.S. Department of Education so that when President Obama took office, there were a number of key high-ranking Gates Foundation people who shifted over into the Department of Education. And lo and behold, when the Department of Education got $4.5 billion of stimulus money to spend, those grants, which were called Race to the Top, were tailored according to Gates Foundation priorities. So we had grants that were only available to states that were willing to implement these Gatesian reforms, things like removing the cap on charter schools, tying teacher evaluation to test scores. Those were required elements if you wanted access to this pot of money. So dozens and dozens of states changed their state laws to be able to apply for these funds. And then, of course, it was a competition, so only a fraction of the states even got the money, but they had changed their laws in order to qualify for these funds. And now we have something called No Child Left Behind waivers, because states are under a tremendous amount of pressure from No Child Left Behind. In order to escape that pressure, the Department of Education will grant a state waivers, but again, only if those states have adopted Common Core, have implemented testing. Technically, they don't have to adopt Common Core. They have to adopt what the Department of Education defines as college and career-ready standards. And of course, Common Core are the most readily available college and career-ready standards. So most states adopted Common Core in order to qualify for that. They have to, again, remove the limits on charter schools and evaluate teachers based on test scores. insignificant part. So the Gates Foundation has been, on the one hand, tremendously successful in advancing this agenda. The only problem is that agenda has, by and large, not succeeded. And so we're now 4 years out from Waiting for Superman. We're 5 years into the Obama administration and the full-throated embrace of these policies by the Obama administration's Department of Education, and we are not seeing the results that we were promised. Charter schools, by and large, are not delivering any significant advantage. In fact, in many states, less regulated states, they're showing significant disadvantages compared to regular public school. Teacher evaluations based on test scores has not increased test scores, just created a lot of demoralization on the part of teachers and students. So we're getting to a point where the whole Common Core standards and the tests aligned with them are also not delivering the kind of transformation that was promised. And so people are starting to kick the tires a little bit on this reform project and see that this promised revolution is actually largely smoke and mirrors.
It's probably the single best description of the situation that I've heard to date, how we got to this point. Let me go back on a couple of things. Certainly, people know about Gates. In some ways, it's almost the opposite of the notion of diverse, egalitarian society that recognizes everybody's uniqueness. It's to create a system, when you turn on that computer, that is exactly the opposite of that diversity. Clearly, most parents listening to this are thinking that the children are about as different from a piece of software as one could get. Do you get a sense that he understands those issues?
Well, here's the funny thing. There is a value to standardization, and he used the example of an electric socket. But you would not insist that electric sockets should be the focus of creative enterprise. In other words, that we need different electric sockets to address our individuality. We can all get by with an electric socket that's the same. And then we do creative things with things that we plug into the electric sockets. So the question is, what do you define as that electric socket that should be standardized? And what do you define as the things that should be creative and open to real innovation? Now, in Bill Gates's mind, and he's made this clear in some recent speeches, he said that the classroom is like an electric socket. And innovation to take place in the creation of appliances or things that plug into that socket. And we want inventiveness in all sorts of different tools. So what he says is we make the classroom standardized, and then the innovators create all sorts of different appliances. And what he's thinking about when he's describing this as appliances are the learning systems, the digital devices, the learning platforms. And there is a proliferation of the Pearson and learning modules, or it's the iPad system. There's a lot of these technological systems, a lot of which are connected with these big data systems that are now coming onto the market. And so the idea is that we make the classrooms standardized. The teacher becomes, they describe this as sort of a student-centered model. I consider it a device-centered model rather than a student-centered model because everything is flowing through that device. But they call this personalized because the student is being tracked and monitored and the system is adjusting to the student. But the teacher is kind of out of the equation as a creative agent. The teacher is basically a facilitator to make sure that the student knows how to use the program and is on task, and then the teacher is fed data as well so that they can monitor the student's performance and make sure that they're using the learning system appropriately. But that's how the electric socket is defined. For me, as a classroom teacher, the science teacher for 18 years in Oakland, I have a lot invested in the idea of teachers and students being creative agents of the learning process. So to me, it's very offensive, the idea that you're going to turn the classroom into that electric socket. I think electric sockets are fine. I have nothing against them being standardized. But when you take that analogy and say you're going to standardize the whole classroom so as to make it possible for these creators of these technologically based learning systems to create millions of products that all fit all of the classrooms across the country, I think you're barking up the wrong tree.
And so if you describe that and you think about the notion that standards are good, nothing wrong with developing standards, although you'd really want them developed by educators and people who have an appreciation for how all children can learn, but not necessarily all learn in the same way at the same time, even if you have the computers defining that. But the idea that these standards have to be the same across the country, and then you test against those standards, I guess the first question that comes to mind is, why would you start that testing without implementing the standards over time and allowing curriculum to be developed? It almost seems that you're guaranteeing failure from the front end, or that you want to guarantee failure by testing people against the standards that have yet even to be implemented, as opposed to saying, let's take 10 or 15 years to develop standards and implement them and then begin the testing process.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I think part of the problem with the whole mentality that's coming along is there's a guy named Christensen who came up with this idea of disruption, creative disruption, and there's a market mentality that says public education is a monopoly. And I think Governor Cuomo recently said something to this effect, that he wanted to break up the public school monopoly, the monopoly that public schools have over education. And in this market mentality, disruption is a creative force. And so we've been, in a sense, under this disruptive framework ever since No Child Left Behind came along, because No Child Left Behind sort of said schools are going to be failing if they don't increase their test scores. And if they're failing, then they're basically bankrupt. And if they're bankrupt, then they should be shut down. So that's what the Department of Education has been doing ever since No Child Left Behind came along, is closing down public schools. And so in this viewpoint, the fact that schools are having terrible trouble and students are failing by the millions these tests is okay. It just proves the inadequacy of our education system for meeting the demands of the 21st century. And by the way, since the public schools have failed, let's forget about the public schools as a vehicle for equitable education, and instead let's turn into a market-driven system. And that's why we have the proliferation of charters and the promotion of vouchers and so on.
And you raise in your book what I guess is the logical question that comes from the description that you just said, and that was the notion that college and career ready is the goal with the very high set of standards that they openly designed to ensure that 3/4 of the children cannot meet, you really do begin to create an even more bifurcated society in which inequity becomes not only the norm, but is actually guaranteed to continue. One wants to be careful about conspiratorial ideas, yeah, but there's certainly something here that leads you to wonder whether that's the case.
Well, every week we see another article about how society has become more inequitable. And the middle class is, you know, what we used to consider the quote-unquote comfortable middle class is practically ceasing to exist. Even people with college degrees are having a great deal of trouble finding jobs that actually compensate them for their education. So a light bulb went off when there was an interview that Bill Gates gave a few months ago at the American Enterprise Institute. And that's a very friendly place for him to give an interview. When I've seen him give interviews before with people, there's a great interview with a British journalist by the name of Jeremy Paxton. And Paxton is pressing Bill Gates on the issue of wealth inequity. And Gates just utterly denies that there's inequity, that inequity is growing. He says, oh no, there's more equality now. There's less inequity now than there was in the past. And he sort of defines poverty in a very specific way as people who are actually starving or homeless. And by that definition, he claims that there's less poverty now than there has been in the past. But in this interview at the American Enterprise Institute, he said a couple of things that were really interesting. One is he said there's research that shows that he acknowledged that capitalism over time tends to increase inequality. And then he said technology reduces the demand for labor. And he said people haven't adjusted their mental models to this. And he made reference, I think, to the study that I read, which predicts that over the next 20 years, about 47% of the current jobs in the United States will disappear because of technological advances. We're talking about all sorts of jobs, especially in the lower middle class, things like driving cars even, because Google is working on the driverless car. People think, oh, well, that will be wonderful. Well, there are about 2 million people in the United States that make their living driving vehicles. So if Google manages to perfect the driverless car, that's possibly as many as 2 million people out of work. So what does that mean if there's 40 or 50% fewer jobs in just 20 years? That means that only a small fraction of the people that are currently graduating from high school are going to get jobs. So what do we do as a society when a whole class of jobs is being eliminated or significantly reduced? And what Gates has suggested is that we have some sort of earned income tax credit, or basically like a subsidy that goes to people that pays them enough that they are prevented from starving and from dying of cold, but some sub-minimum wage amount that would allow them to not actually perish from the face of the earth. But presumably it's not going to be so much that you wouldn't still be motivated to work. So it's going to be some very minimal amount. And there'll be a large number of people that are unemployable. Now, if they're unemployable because the economy doesn't need them, what do we say to them? Do we say you're unemployable because the advantages of technology are going to go to the top 1%, and the rest of the people who don't happen to have a part of that slice of pie are just your surplus, and so here's your $500 a month, make sure that you don't freeze to death? Or do we say that manufacturing's all been outsourced to some place where people will work for 50 cents an hour? Or do we say instead, you very unfortunately did not take advantage of the education you were given. You didn't show yourself to be career ready. You didn't show yourself to be ready for college. You didn't work hard enough to pass the rigorous tests that we gave you. So I'm sorry, that's tough on you, but we don't need you. So go over here and collect your meal ticket.
And it raises the point, the famous quote from Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education, saying that we should be able to look every second grader,
yeah,
in the eye and tell them whether they're on track to be a success. So as a teacher, does Bill Gates really believe that? Or was Duncan just sort of out in front of himself? Or is this part of the Gates idea? And secondly, as a teacher, how do you address the reality of what second graders are like compared to college?
Well, educationally, it's absurd to talk to a second grader about whether they're on track for college. That really has no real meaning for a second grader. And the only way you can give it meaning is to be actually very frightening to a second grader. I heard a principal say once, you know, we tell our students they need to do well in school so that they can go to college, so that they can have a family and a home. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, what are they actually saying? They're saying if you don't do well on these tests, you're going to be homeless and you won't be able to have a family. And that's sort of the message, that we are going to scare people into caring about the tests that we have made so consequential. And it's a really horrible, as an educator, it's the last thing that you want to do to motivate and engage students. You know, if I were to start each day of my teaching and say, okay, we're going to learn this, and they say, well, why are we learning this? Well, if you don't learn this, you're going to flunk the test. If you flunk the test, you can't go to college. If you can't go to college, then you can't get a job and you'll be homeless. I mean, that is a dismal philosophy of education. When I was in the classroom, I was constantly trying to find ways to engage students, ways to make them interested in the material that we were studying. And I must say, once in a while, I would say, look, this is going to be on the test. But honestly, any time I said that, I felt like I'd kind of lost the battle, because I was using some sort of hammer to try to threaten them into learning, and it just doesn't work.
as parents and others think about, teachers think about the absurdity of saying to a second grader, you are on track, you're not on track, for all of us that have older children who still haven't figured out exactly, or us who haven't figured out exactly what we're doing with this life. It does sound very dystopian. And I guess compare that then to the question of if all of the academic evidence and certainly what teachers and other experts are saying is that the real factors to educational achievement, the barriers to educational achievement are poverty, language barriers, and special education needs that are not properly addressed. What does the Gates mentality say, since you don't hear them talking a lot about appropriate funding or increased funding? Do they just deny that poverty, language barriers, and special ed? Or is there some hidden thing in which they're going to roll out programs that, for example, deal with the fact that here in Hartford, Connecticut, more than half the children go home to households that don't speak English. And while Spanish is a primary language, in fact, there are 107 different languages that are spoken in the homes of Hartford, Connecticut public school children. And there has been nothing that I've seen in the Gates material that says, how do you deal with the fact that you have now communities in which either the poverty, the language barriers, and the unmet special education needs really are preventing the vast majority of children from being successful academically?
Well, one of the central chapters of the book about the Gates Foundation's work, I really tried to confront them on the issue of poverty. And I pointed out all the ways that poverty affects learning. And, you know, the fact that we don't have the luxury of ignoring poverty in our schools, it intrudes constantly. Well, when I pointed that out, basically, they said, well, sure, poverty is a big deal, but we can't address poverty. We don't have the resources to do it. And they said, we're committed to eliminating the cause of poverty, but basically, they think education is the way out of poverty, and that's where they're focusing their efforts.
Which, of course, goes back to that idea of if there aren't the jobs, if there isn't the systems in place to deal with poverty, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that, you know, let's theoretically say that we are providing kids college and career ready, and yet they're coming out with student loans that they can't pay off, that they have jobs that they can't buy homes, that they can't afford to have a family, or if they have a family, they can't afford to have all of them.
There's a whole mythology, I think, around the magicness of a college degree in terms of being a ticket to the middle class. And there's a lot of retrospective studies that look at the impact of a college degree on your earning potential. And seeing, I'm sure, the graphs that show if you have no high school diploma, your lifetime earnings are this much. If you have a high school diploma, you know, maybe you're going to earn $20,000 a year. If you have an AA degree, you know, maybe you'll make $25,000 and so on. Problem with those studies is they're all looking backwards. They're all looking at data from the 1990s and 2000s and saying, okay, here's what people with college degrees were earning over those 10 years. And therefore, we're going to assume that going forward, that's going to continue to be the case. The fact is that right now, roughly a third of the 25 to 29-year-olds have college degrees. And that's a pretty high proportion of the overall population. There are not going forward going to be middle-class jobs, comfortable middle-class jobs, for the majority of people with college degrees. If you look at the profile of the jobs that were created since the 2008 crash, the majority of jobs that were created that came back into the economy are low-paying jobs. So jobs that were in the economy 10 or 15 years ago simply aren't there. Instead, you're going to work at an Amazon fulfillment center trying to fill these little boxes to get $12 an hour. And that's the future of the American workforce if we don't have some more fundamental economic restructuring.
In the few minutes that we have left, now that you've laid out this terrifying and dystopian society that we have emerging into, two things. One is, are there things that can be done, should be done, that do provide children with the educational tools that they need to live more fulfilling lives? And then secondly, where can people get more information about the very things that you've been talking about?
Well, certainly there's things that can be done. I mean, children are children, and what they need is genuine personalization, which means small class sizes, which means teachers that are given the autonomy and time to give them the care that they need, the attention that they need. You know, it isn't that difficult a formula to create. Wealthy people actually have implemented it in the schools that they send their children to. So if we want the best, we can just look at Lakeside Academy, where Bill Gates sends his children. We can look at Sidwell Friends Schools, where the Obamas go. And that kind of nurturing environment is what children need. You know, children are living, growing, developing creatures. They don't need the same thing, in a sense, but they do need the same thing. They all need room to grow. It's kind of like a garden. You do have some basic things that they need in terms of how to grow, and so we do know that. There is a growing movement to try to push back on the Gates Foundation's vision for reform. People have been pushing back on Common Core for several years now. There are people who are pushing against the privatization of education. I work with an organization called the Network for Public Education, which was founded a couple of years ago by Diane Ravitch. And we'll be gathering activists together in Chicago in a few months at the end of April. You can find us on the web, networkforpublicEducation.org, or on Facebook, or on Twitter. And you can find my blog, it's called livinginDialogue.com. And I feature a lot of voices of teachers and students speaking out about these issues. And so there are a lot of people who are getting activated around this. I think there's a growing movement. Of course, this movement is connected to other movements for social justice across the country. And so as those movements grow, then consciousness grows around the need for genuine reform. I think part of what's happened is education has been used as not only a scapegoat, but a diversion. In a sense, we can pretend that we're going to fix inequity by making schools better and by holding teachers accountable for better test scores. And then if we get better test scores, somehow this is going to translate into a growing middle class. Meanwhile, we ignore the actual fundamental economic conditions that affect the middle class. We ignore the fact that in order to go to college, students are having to pile up this huge debt. We ignore the actual economic conditions in the country, and we pretend that our schools are going to somehow fix it. We need to get over that delusion right away, not only because it's damaging our schools, but also because it prevents us from actually addressing these economic issues that are really wrecking the futures for our children.
Well, thank you. You've provided a real shine the light of truth on these issues and given people a lot to think about. Anthony Cody, a retired science teacher with years of experience in the Oakland school system. The book is The Educator and the Oligarch, A Teacher Challenges the Gates Foundation. And we urge every listener to pick that up and to read it because it really provides a blueprint of the problems that we're facing and the path towards getting those problems resolved. So, Anthony, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks, Jonathan.
And that was a discussion between Jonathan Pelto and Anthony Cody, who's the author of the recently released book, The Educator and the Oligarch. And Jonathan Pelto is here in the studio with me now. Jonathan, thank you for that very informative interview with Anthony Cody concerning his book, The Educator and the Oligarch. And as we've seen, those issues are playing out right here in Connecticut, and maybe you can give us an update on the current legislative session.
Great, thank you. And as always, thank you for inviting me to be part of this important discussion around public education and the efforts by the corporate education reform industry to take over public education and privatize it and really undermine the teaching profession. And sadly, their ongoing effort to turn our schools into little more than Common Core standardized testing factories. That what Anthony talked about in his book, and highly recommend that anybody interested in public education read it because it lays out at the national level how we got to this point. At the state level, there is starting to be more and more of a pushback against that. Sadly, there does not appear to be any change in policy at the federal level. As we've talked about before, this is a bipartisan attack on public education. It really started with George Bush II and his so-called Texas miracle that turned out not to be true in fixing the public education system in Texas. And he proposed the No Child Left Behind. And that was followed by Barack Obama's Race to the Top, which took those concepts of the Common Core, standardized testing, focus exclusively on English and math, and really downplaying things like social studies and the other elements of a comprehensive education. And the Obama administration took it even further with their Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. The United States Congress is now in the process of looking at the redoing of or reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind. It would have been a perfect opportunity to get this country off of the corporate education reform bandwagon. But sadly, between a Republican-controlled legislature or Republican-controlled Congress and the president's support for these issues, it actually looks like Washington is going to continue to go in the wrong direction. So if we are going to have a pushback, it's going to be coming from the state level. And that's exactly what seems to be taking place. A number of states are seriously talking about pulling out of the Common Core and refusing to engage in the constant standardized testing. Other states are pretending that that's what they want to do, but are really replacing it with different forms of the Common Core. And some states are moving dramatically in the wrong direction. Probably the single best example of that is in Wisconsin, where they are actually seriously discussing doing away with public education and simply privatizing the entire public education system of Wisconsin. Now, that would be a long shot, except with Scott Walker as their governor and a right-wing Republican legislature, it's possible that we will see Wisconsin moving to a level that no state has ever imagined, and that is doing to an entire state what has happened in New Orleans. New Orleans is the only school system or the largest school system that is now 100% privatized. It's all charter schools, and the data and the studies that are coming back saying that there has been absolutely no improvement. In fact, the number of problems may very well have gotten significantly worse because so much of the money in charter schools is being wasted and so much of it is being siphoned off to line people's pockets. So that brings us here to Connecticut. We're at the beginning of a very important legislative session. The session began in the beginning of January and will run until the beginning of June. This is a session that will focus primarily on the Connecticut state budget problems. The state is going to face a $1.4 billion budget deficit. We're likely to see significant cuts and significant efforts to try to use budget gimmicks to balance the state budget. But behind the budget debate are a couple of very important issues, one of which will relate to some of the things that we've been talking about in the education reform arena. There is growing recognition that the Common Core and the standardized testing is reducing the quality of education in Connecticut, certainly not improving it. There have been over a dozen bills introduced into the Connecticut legislature that would modify or even repeal the way in which Connecticut is following the Common Core, bills that would significantly reduce the use of standardized testing, including bills that would prevent the standardized testing results from being unfairly used in evaluating teachers. There's a bill that would require the standardized test results to be given to parents. There's bills that would require school districts in the state to inform parents about all of the data that is being collected by the state and by these testing companies, and the lack of appropriate privacy protections for students. One of the interesting things is that almost all, or in fact, in this case, all of these bills are being introduced by Republican state legislators. And because the Democrats control the governorship and the House and the Senate, these Republican legislators will be facing an uphill battle to get their bills, having public hearing, getting their bills through committee, getting their bills passed. But there will be public hearings taking place in February and in March around these issues. And the Education Committee, which finishes up its work in April, beginning of May, will be either pushing these bills forward or not, and parents and other people concerned about public education should be making their voices heard by following the debate, following what's going on with these pieces of legislation, and certainly telling legislators whether or not they want these bills to be developed into full proposals and passed by the legislature. And many of these bills would dramatically slow down the corporate education reform movement's effort in Connecticut and begin the process of returning the word public to public education.
And Jonathan, let's go back a minute to the opting out. Parents have the right to opt their children out of these high-stakes tests. But I've heard teachers tell me that they don't have the right, that they've been told that they don't. And maybe you could speak to that more clearly. They definitely have the right, correct, to opt their children out.
Correct. There is no question that parents have the right to opt their children out of these unfair and inappropriate Common Core standardized tests. I think a growing number of parents are realizing these tests are problematic. As we've talked about here and as I have written about on my blog, other commentators have written about, not only do these standardized tests take up huge amounts of time, and not only are they extraordinarily expensive and that students are losing a lot of instructional time, but the tests are actually designed so that the vast majority of students fail. What's called the cut score, meaning what counts as a student that is at goal or not at goal. The Connecticut Mastery Test, which has been around for all these years, and anyone with children knows that their children took the Mastery Test. Younger adults will have taken the Mastery Test themselves. That was a test that did try to measure to some degree or another what was being taught in the classroom and whether students were learning it. There were still problems with it, but nothing like what these Common Core tests are. The Common Core, for all intents and purposes, is testing students on what is the content two grade levels above where they are. So it ensures that the students will fail. And in fact, what the statistical evidence is that the tests will result in about 70% of the children being deemed as failures. Only about 30% will be at goal. And the people behind the Common Core testing are very open about that. They had a vote where they decided where to define who succeeds and who fails. They had a vote that put a demarcation on what counts as a passing grade. And they purposely picked it so that about 70% of the students, 7 in 10, would not succeed. That means that we would go from the Connecticut Mastery Test, which was 60, 70, 80% of the children at goal, to starting this year where only 20, 30% of the children are at goal. So one of the reasons that parents need to think about opting out is that even if we were to keep the Common Core, it needs to be restructured completely and revamped. There are significant problems with it to start with, but the fact that they are using it to judge children and that they've designed a test that is intentionally going to fail the vast majority of children means that parents really have to think about the damage that it does not only to their school and their teachers, but quite frankly to their children. That if we don't do something and we know that 70% of the children are going to be told they're failures, and in urban areas that number could increase to 90% or more of the children being told they're failures, that parents should really think about stepping forward and opting their children out of the test. That is, telling their school districts that they refuse to allow their children to be tested. There is a law that requires the schools to conduct the test, but there is no law that requires parents to have their children be tested. And in fact, even the chairman of the State Board of Education, somebody who supports these tests, said before a legislative committee that there is no law that prevents parents from opting their children out. Unfortunately, what the Malloy administration did was they sent out letters to all of the superintendents and the principals, who then passed it on to the teachers, saying that children could not legally be opted out. And so many principals and many teachers don't actually know what the law is. They tell people what they think the law is, but they actually have it wrong, completely wrong. And there's absolutely no law. The school districts cannot punish the parent or the child in any way. And that one of the things that parents should be thinking about. And in New York, there are actually thousands, tens of thousands of parents that are opting their children out. Here in Connecticut, the number is much lower because parents have not been told that they have the right to opt their children out of these tests. But in New York, there are complete school districts that are refusing to take the test. The difference in New York, because they're a year ahead of us, they've already seen the damaging effect. There are actually entire school districts that are saying, we will not give this test. Sadly, in Connecticut, to my knowledge, every school district has agreed to give the test. And so it's up to parents to protect their children and their schools and their teachers.
And just so the listeners know, there is a website that can help them out with that. It's called unitedoptout.org. They have sample forms on there that you can go to and use to give to your district saying that you're opting your children out. Also, Jonathan, maybe you can speak to, if you don't opt your children out, then all the data collection that they're maintaining on every child, and what is the downside of that?
That's right. And people would confirm and echo your remarks that parents should take a look at the optout.org website. It will provide them with important information. I have and will continue to write about the rights of parents to opt their children out on my blog, Wait What?, which can be found under www.jonathanpelto.com. But one of the things that parents should be most concerned about is that the amount of data that is being collected and being turned over to private vendors is unprecedented. Not only are they keeping, of course, all of the test scores on these databases, but they will have all kinds of information about the child, about when the child took the tests, how long they took the tests, how long each question they took, the results of each and every question. And what we know is that they will be developing what they call algorithms to determine which kinds of children have what kinds of chances of quote-unquote success or failure, and that all of this data being collected and controlled by people who are beyond the reach of local school boards, the tremendous questions about the confidentiality and the privacy. It was not long ago that parents could be assured that data that was collected on their children was kept private. The Obama administration changed that policy without the legislative approval to allow huge amounts of data to be collected and to be shared with private testing companies. And now parents actually have almost no ability to know what data is being collected, how it's being stored, whether or not it's at risk of being hacked into, or even what the data will be used for in the future. And one could definitely imagine that this data will be developed in such a way that children 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, or maybe across their entire life, will be judged by what the data says about them that is maintained in these massive databases. And so one of the other reasons that parents should think seriously about opting their children out of the standardized test is that until we can be sure that that data is not going to be used to haunt those children for the years to come, that it is better to ensure that the government and these private companies don't get the data in the first place. And since especially there's nothing that the school districts can do to punish the child or punish the adult, it seems to me and seems to a lot of other people that the upside of opting out is so much more important for everybody than the downside, that the real danger is to actually take these tests. Not only will they be judging your children and judging your children's teachers by these inappropriate tests, some of which are developmentally inappropriate, that this idea, and it was best stated by Obama's Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, both of whom are Democrats. Obama and Duncan is a Democrat. So this isn't just a Democrat and Republican issue, but Arne Duncan famously or infamously said that we should be able to look every second grader in the eye and tell them whether or not that they will be successful in college and whether they're on track to be successful. Well, all of us who have children know that there are so many factors that lead to quote-unquote success or not success, and that, in fact, academic success is only one of the variables that goes into what makes a fulfilling life. That when our highest-ranking education official has the audacity to say that the government should be able to look at every second grader in the eye and tell them whether they're going to be a success is something that is scarier and more inappropriate than anything George Orwell ever wrote about in his books. And yet this is the policy of the federal government. It's the policy of the state government. And the one thing that parents can do to derail this is simply to say, my child is not going to participate in this scam.
Yeah, that is really very frightening. We've got this narrow test that doesn't test most of what you learn in school, and then they're going to be using that data to direct your child maybe in the future. You don't know how that's going to affect jobs or whatever, so that's very frightening.
One of the things that, and again, we've talked about it, but it's worth talking about again, is that this isn't to say that we shouldn't be working to improve our schools and that we shouldn't be working to ensure that schools have adequate resources. It's a question of what do they do with those resources? And parents and anybody who really is out there in the workplace knows that children need a comprehensive education in order to succeed. That the days of getting one job and working at that job for 50 years and then retiring are long gone. And what the corporate education reform industry says and what these corporate education reform politicians say is that if we just focus in on English and math, then children will be college and career ready. That just is an absurd approach to what life is really like. Learning about all of the various aspects, becoming able to think for themselves, able to question what's going on, being able to have taken things like art and music, physical education, having taken social studies and other courses, is what makes somebody capable of being able to go with the ups and downs of modern life. And instead, because this really is driven by the corporate desire to have students that have a certain set of skills, our education system is being corrupted into something that will produce students who may be better in one or two areas, but will then be less able to deal with all of the complexities of life. So for all of those reasons and more, I think the responsible parent is one who goes in and says, I may not be able to control what Barack Obama or even Governor Malloy does, but I can control what happens to my child. And my child is not going to be allowed to participate in this scam, and that if they want my child to participate in class and programs, then they need to provide a broader array of programs that will give my child the knowledge and skills and ability to succeed rather than simply being trained as human robots.
Right. I was at a conference once and I heard the speaker say that there are a lot of people who can read really well and take tests really well who are doing really horrible things around the world. So it is important to have that broader education where people have critical thinking skills, et cetera.
And those critical thinking skills are going to become increasingly important. One of the issues that, again, we've talked about here is with the lack of information, with people not being able to get all of the facts from the mainstream media. What you don't want are people who are going to listen and believe everything they're told. What you want is people who are going to listen and challenge everything that they're told. That not only makes them better for a democracy and our nation better as a democracy, but it allows people to decide for themselves what is and what is not true, and also to allow them to be in the workplace a much more important part of determining their own lives and determining what they want to do with their lives. And so one always wants to be careful not to be overly melodramatic, but the only way to derail this corporate education reform industry is for them to have parents who are saying, we're not going to allow you to do this to our children, in which case you'll then start to have politicians who realize that they should be on the side of parents and teachers and not on the side of these corporate education industries.
Yeah, and so I want to encourage people to get out there and call your legislators, your state legislators, and give them your opinions on this. Ask them to support the bills in the state legislature that will change some of these laws in favor of our children.
One of the good signs and the belief that we can make a difference is that when the Common Core was adopted, there was no opposition to it whatsoever. And when Governor Malloy's Education Reform Initiative was adopted in 2012, there was no opposition. The fact that legislators are now proposing bills to do away with major segments of what Governor Malloy had proposed is probably the best sign that politicians are listening and are learning. They didn't know either all of these things. And because parents are speaking up and because children are being hurt by these policies and teachers are being hurt by these policies and our local schools are being hurt by these policies, you now have legislators starting to do the right thing. And as I noted earlier, it's interesting that to date, all of those bills have been introduced by Republicans. And of course, in the political world, people say, well, the Democrats are more pro-education and liberal. Republicans are more conservative and pro-business. Well, in fact, because this is a bipartisan attack on public education and because the political parties are so much similar to each other these days, it's refreshing to see that it's actually Republicans who are stepping forward Let's just hope that some of the Democrats decide to catch on as well.
Yeah, really good point, Jonathan. And unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, as always.
As I've mentioned in previous shows, privatization is not just happening in Connecticut or the U.S. The global elite are pushing it around the world, and not just in public education. As you know, here in the U.S., we have privatized prisons, healthcare, pensions, intelligence, military operations, and a lot more. The dangers of privatization are that once profit is involved, services decline and accountability vanishes. It generally costs more and gives us less. We can see the mess it's made to many of our basic services in the areas just mentioned. And it also gives great power over our lives to the individuals who own these privatized institutions. And it undermines democracy. So this is not a time to be passive. Our combined efforts are needed to stop the privatization of our public schools. So here's a list of organizations and books that can get you started. So we have Diane Ravitch's book called The Reign of Error. There's her website, Diane Ravitch, and that's Ravitch is R-A-V-I-T-C-H, dianeravitch.com. Then we have jonathanpelto.com, and the following websites, www.networkforpubliceducation.org, parentsacrossamerica.org, realhartford.org, badassteacher.org, and unitedoptout.com. And this unitedoptout.com, I really want to recommend because it has a lot of information on there by state about what's going on and the testing that's involved. And it also has resources about what you can do. So I would really encourage you to check that one out, unitedoptout.com. And then, of course, we have the new book by Anthony Cody, whom you heard speak today, called The Educator and the Oligarch. And his website, which is livingindialogue.com. And now I want to thank you for tuning in and listening to this 11th edition of The Assault on Public Education. The Assault on Public Education airs the last Monday of every month at 12 noon. And the shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four. So radioforall.net. And once on the site in the search box, if you type in The Assault on Public Education, the show should all pop up. And I'm going to close the show today with the first part of a song by Van Morrison called Educating Archie. And here it is. Tell me what.